Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo So the occasion of listening to some teachings, it's really mainly, it's you can say principally two parts to it. One is to hear something about the Buddha's teachings. The other part is to be able to contemplate them, see what is relevant for you, and also whether you sort of, whether it resonates with you. I see the Buddha's teachings a bit like it's a particular context. We all grow up in a context. Everything we do is within a context. You know, it's sort of an unusual context these days. Here is a Buddhist teachings been given in a Western country. Now it's a Western country. To people who grow up with a whole range of, I mean, I was going to say Christian background, but it's quite a mixed variety of people here, different backgrounds. And we bring all this with us. It's our baggage we bring with us. So what we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, or think is all conditioned by that. It's all filtered through our certain personal biases, if you like. So even we hear something kind of more objective, like the Buddha's experience, we're still interpreting it through our own world, through our own impressions, our own degree of understanding. So that's why, I mean, the Buddha pointed out the value of contemplation, that we don't just take it so-called literally, what we hear, but we should contemplate, reflect upon it, consider it. Can say, find out for ourselves if it really works for us, really useful for us. Even we hear other people say they benefited or they praise it or whatever, but it's a work for us. We don't know till we find out for ourselves. And of course, within this Buddha's teachings, I mean, there's some of it is maybe palatable to us, can understand it, we even like it maybe. Other parts of it are a bit confusing. Other parts perhaps we find some resistance to. And it's helpful to kind of look in our own heart and notice these different, you know, different experiences, different ways that we react, if you like, to what we hear, read, study ourselves, whatever. Sometimes that even the things we don't like about it, they show us a lot about ourselves. You know, is it actually what's being said, or is it just our reaction to it? And of course, within this Buddhist teachings, one of the kind of fundamental bases of it, which I've been repeating a number of times, is the principle of cause and effect. And this is kind of foundational to the Buddha's whole, his enlightenment, his way of presenting the teachings, and to the experience that he's trying to direct us towards. One of the most important ones, I guess you can say, is we hear it a lot about in Buddhism anyway, and not now it's even a word in the Oxford English Dictionary, principle of karma or kamma in Pali. And unfortunately, you know, it's a word that's used in different contexts. The Buddha, when he taught in India at that time, there was a certain context for it. The word karma, people had heard it very often. They knew what it meant. But he gave it a new spin. He gave it a new interpretation. And even today, it's still not understood what he meant by a lot of people. You hear people, you know, new agey people saying, "Oh, just my karma." You know, when something happens to them, or they need an excuse for something, just my karma. You know, you get angry with somebody and say, "Oh, just my karma. It's okay." Don't take it personally. But the point is that actually karma is personal. It's what we do ourselves. And the Buddha pointed out, you know, he gave it a special definition of intention. So, I mean, the word originally means action. And, of course, you know, people can see reasonably easily what people do, what their action is. But how to know their intention? You know, the real key factor for the Buddha was the person's intention, their state of mind, if you like. So you can notice people's actions. You can say something or do something, but can you read their mind? You know their intentions. But that is the crucial factor in determining the effects of karma, the result of the action. And then, of course, there is another, the result of it, the effect, is something else. I mean, when people say it's just my karma, what they really mean is, you know, this is the effect, because the action is what you do, and then there is the effect called vipaka, and the two separate things. So what they're actually implying is that's the result of their previous actions. They're this way, you know. They get angry at you and say, "Oh, it's just my karma," because their temperament, they've already built a temperament of anger, a way of, you know, reacting to the world. They're an angry person, you know, because they keep feeding that activity of aversion, aversion, aversion. They keep acting in an adverse way, so they get an adverse habit, and it gives them the result of being an angry person. But it's very important, I would say, to be able to keep cause and effect separate. Otherwise, they get stuck together. People are saying, "It's just my karma." But and then they kind of, you start to believe it, and then you grasp it, and you turn it into something which is more tangible than it actually is. The Buddha is saying that this karma is intention. Where's intention? Huh? It's not a thing, is it? It's a state of mind. Whereas if you say, "Oh, just my karma," you're implying that it is actually something. You know, it's your habit tendency, which is more solid than it is, but it's based upon just your intention. So you can say then, you know, it's a bit more fluid, it's less tangible, it's less solid. At the same time, you know, it's important for us to be able to know what that is too. If you don't know what your intention is, how do you get some control over it? And the whole Buddhist way of practice, spiritual practice, is based upon these principles, because when we can understand our intentions, and we understand what is good intention and what is bad intention, or we say the skillful and the unskillful, or wholesome and unwholesome, then we can learn to act in a skillful way. And we can try to reduce the unskillfulness, the unwholesomeness. Can reduce the bad actions, if you like. And then there's a whole, you know, training system now. You can say morality, meditation, wisdom, to help us, to facilitate that. It's not just a good idea, but the Buddha gives us very concrete examples how to do that practically on different levels. So, of course, I mean, you know, the first thing is to be able to understand what our intentions are, which really points to a certain degree of self-knowing, a certain degree of awareness, self-awareness. So if you just were to ask yourself, for example, you know, what's the intention that brought you here, you know, here to a Buddhist monastery? You know, Here it is, Saturday night. How many millions of Australians are out partying somewhere? And here you are monasterying on a Friday on a Saturday night. What makes the difference? Huh? What's the intention that brings you here to this place to meditate rather than go to the party? Of course, be careful you don't think about it too much, because the first thing I observed was, of course, these intentions have quite a different degree of levels to them. You can just say flippantly, "Oh, I want a holiday," you know, maybe sort of flippantly. "Yeah, I had enough parties, sorry," you know. But, you know, what's behind that now? What's the deeper level of that? That you appreciate some degree of collectedness, some calm in your mind, rather than excitement and stimulation? Why is that? Why do you do that? You know, if I was to kind of look in my history, my past, you know, and say, you know, why was I the only of my graduating class at high school, about 50 people, why am I the only one who's a Buddhist monk? There was one of the monks when he was living in Thailand, and when he visited his parents in America, he got a letter. They had a letter from his high school, and they were having a reunion. So he decided to go along to this reunion just to see some of his old school friends. They went to it, and I mean, one of the things he said that he was voted the one who has the most unusual vocation. I don't think anybody else in high school was a Buddhist monk. He was the only one. So he had a first anyway. First as being unusual vocation. And then you can also look at the intensity. I mean, that's another qualifying factor of intention, which colors the effect. It's the degree or the intensity of that intention. You know, I've seen many people, you know, they come to the monastery for very, very variety of reasons. You know, some just want a little bit of peace of mind, and so they come on a retreat, and even they work very hard at it, and then you never see them again. Usually at the beginning of retreats, I would ask people what their experience was, just so I get some general idea. And this one man said to me, I said, "Oh, is this your first time here?" He said, "Oh, no. He said, "No, I did a retreat 20 years ago. This is my second retreat." I said, either the first one wasn't very impressive, or they've been very busy in the meantime, you know, 20 years. But, you know, he didn't forget it anyway. Did come back for the second time. Never saw him again, mind you. It takes another 20 years before he goes to the third retreat. Somebody else I asked about what their experience was, and they gave me a list of a dozen people they've been, a dozen different teachers they've been to. But, oh my goodness. What can I say to them? Spiritual dilettantes. But unless we're able to get a bit of perspective on what our intentions are, and it requires also quite a bit of honesty with ourselves. I mean, so much of our relationship to ourselves is usually, you know, I wouldn't say dishonest, but it's very delusional. You know, either we, you know, at the extremes, we think we're better than we really are, or we think we're worse than we really are, or whatever. You have all these impressions from, and just gleamed from different experiences. Yeah, if you remember one experience, you were a failure. Remember something else, and you were a success. And yet it's only one little incident in our life, one little moment in our life. But when you keep thinking about it and keep bringing it up in your mind and going over it again and again, it begins to become more constellated as a as a way of relating to yourself, a way of being then, and a way that you, something you believe in. Yes, that's how I really am. That's my true nature that way, rather than just recognizing as a passing experience. And maybe some of those experiences, they were not only just one-off and accidental, you know, but maybe they were even misinterpreted. You misunderstood it completely. Like there was one person I knew, who was one of the monks actually, and he had a certain way of reacting to people in the monastery. But when we talked to him, you know, he came across very aggressively, I'd say. When I talked to him, he said, "What? You know, I act this way because that's when I feel most vulnerable." This was his way of defending himself, be aggressive. And we all kind of, we just couldn't believe it. It was exactly the opposite of how he presented himself. He presented himself as being very aggressive. But he was defending himself because he felt so vulnerable and weak at that time. Wow, that was an unusual one. But once we're able to get a bit more perspective just on, you know, first of all, you know, like in the meditation exercises, you know, we have this particular instructions to follow. They're very simple, just watch the breath. I mean, it's helpful to have some kind of, you can say, at least some kind of template for what we're doing. At least that you can say, even objectively is helpful, that one can return to. Because for most of us, you can say, watch the breath, but then what do we actually see? We usually see our own stories. How many times, I mean, many of you are very experienced meditators by now, so you know, shouldn't be a shock. But if you were to, you sit down for half an hour or so, and did you have some idea how long during that time you can actually watch your breath and how much of that time you're thinking about yourself? 50-50? That's an advanced meditator, I think. Maybe you can kind of, I don't know if you're going to destroy your meditation or not, but disturb it, but maybe you just try and keep a little count, you know, something, a rough idea, you know, how many minutes on the breath and how many minutes thinking about yourself. But if you didn't have that exercise of watching the breath, you'd probably be thinking about yourself all the time, right? Like most people. I mean, that's their default. Is myself, you know. I want to go here. I want to do this, and you know, I like this. I don't like that. I got a plan for tomorrow, and what happened last week. And it is, watch your breath. Aha, right. Something more objective, rather than always subjective all the time. And not only does that, just that exercise can help us to kind of come out of our self-obsession. But it does have these other side effects, like calming the mind down. Because thinking about yourself, I don't know about you, but thinking about myself is not always very peaceful. It depends which way your mind goes. See, if you had a bad day, then, wow, you just think about all your problems. If you have a good day, maybe it's a little bit more encouraging. But there's always some little gray cloud there somewhere. There's always some little worry there somewhere. But just being able to settle your mind on the breathing, for example, it gives your mind a bit of a rest, some objectivity, rather than always subject, thinking about the subject all the time. Then there is a possibility then to be able to use that objectivity to observe in a different way. You know, who is the thinker of all these thoughts? You know, where do these thoughts come from? Where do these sensations, what's actually going on here? Become the knower of it, the observer of it, rather than the thinker of yourself. So you begin to get some perspective then on this activity, the self-activity. And of course, I mean, it takes maybe a little bit of time before, first of all, we're able to observe without getting, you know, so much pulled into our stories, into the storylines. And the second thing is to be able to, you know, see through them. You know, just having this a certain perspective of the Buddha's teachings. You know, oh, it's just a thought. You know, there's a physical sensation, there's a feeling tone, there's a state of mind happening. You don't need to take it so personal. Everybody has physical sensations. Every sentient being has physical sensations, actually, not just humans. I don't know about the ants. I haven't talked to them recently, but I guess they must have physical sensations too, I guess, you know. They have some kind of sentience of some kind. Obviously, they probably feel pain or something if they get damaged or hurt. So maybe they not only have physical sensations, they have a feeling tone as well. And then there are states of mind, which human beings are especially adapted to, especially skilled at thinking a lot. Then we begin to observe some of these processes, we begin to see through them. I mean, there's a real powerful effect to just awareness itself. The power of awareness, just being aware of some of these processes. Yeah, it's like consciousness. When you're conscious of something, something comes into your consciousness, but it can come out of you, can just float out of your consciousness too. Oh, I know that. So then you more or less forget about it because you know it. But if it's unconscious, you know, what is it? It's not clear yet. I'm not aware of it. I'm not conscious of it. But I know something's there. And we get these little intimations about it, you know, if not in ordinary life, maybe in dreams or something. There's something there, but we become more conscious of it. It's like we just go through it. Don't need to hold on to it. Don't need to make a big story out of it. We know it now, so through that now. Whereas if we don't, if we're resisting, you know, then it becomes even a bigger problem. So the Buddha saw the value of developing mindfulness or awareness. It has its own particular healing power to it. Not only, you can say, psychologically, but spiritually as well. Because when we begin to see through much of our self stories, we begin to see the bigger picture. You know, all these stories are impermanent. They aren't fundamentally personal. We take them personally without understanding them, but they aren't really personal. And wherever we are, there is sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and thinking. Yeah. So the rain falls down, and then we take it personal. Think, oh, it's raining on me. Oh, it's a bad day today. But it just happens. You don't need to take it so personal. And when you begin to see that, it's just you begin to see more impersonal processes happening. So we don't have to react to them. We don't have to hang on to them or push them away. Just this way, just the way things are. And we get more into the flow then of nature, of the way things really are. Where if we put ourselves into it, you know, we get it's like a bit of, you know, a bit of a disturbance in the stream. It's not how it really is. Everybody has their own perspective on it, on certain events, but, you know, things just happen the way they are. And if you can recognize the different perspectives, different points of view, the different angles on things, well, be more tolerant. This person says it this way, this person says it that way, and, well, everybody's right in a way. Some are a little bit more right than others, but and the person who can, you know, recognize the way things are, what really are, consistently, You know, that becomes the wise person. Not being so blinded by their subjectivity of it, by their own interpretation, not holding on to their view is right and everybody else's view is wrong. If you hold on to your view of things, then it becomes really a struggle. And many times you ask yourself, why am I holding on to this view anyway? You know, to reinforce myself, to prove something to somebody, to convince myself that I'm somebody worth listening to or something. So on one hand, it's very helpful. We're very fortunate to be able to have the Buddhist teachings as this template to put on our personal experience. First of all, to be able to see through it, and also to get some perspective on it. You know. Not to deny it, you know, we still have our personal experiences, but if you don't get it in the right perspective, we're left, the default is, it's all mine, it's all my stuff. It's my personal problem I have to work through. Rather than just recognizing it just as processes going on, you know, empty processes. And just doesn't that make you, just to know that intellectually, doesn't it make you feel a bit lighter? Huh? It's not my personal problem. Just processes going on. Yeah. And if we can understand some of these processes, you know, then we can just move through them. You know, sometimes there's troublesome states of mind arise sometimes. You know, with the principle of kamma, you know, the Buddha did also say that knowing what is the result of kamma is one of the unthinkables. You know, it's very hard for people, especially in a country that has Buddhism as the main religion. It's become very popular. It's a popular Buddhism. Is everything's due to karma. See? Everything you do is your karma. But the Buddha said, if that's the case, if you had to reap the results of every single thing you've done in your life and past lives, you'd never be liberated. You'd be a prisoner of your previous actions. But there are skillful actions we can do which can sometimes even erase the effects of previous actions, if not at least attenuate them or alleviate them to some degree. And of course, the ultimate one is understanding. You understand the whole nature of how we built up our sense of self, you can let it go. So you don't have to relive all those experiences that you built up, all those habits you've created around yourself anymore. It's just all feeling tones, sensations, states of mind, all it is. You have a much more lighter approach to them. You know, they are there, you know, they still have an effect. But we aren't holding on to them and making them so tangible and so solid anymore. Maybe we have built up, as it were, a habit of reacting with aversion or anger. That's real. Yeah. That has an effect. But if you take it really personally, then you grab onto it and make it even stronger than it really is. Or if you can recognize that, aha, and don't keep feeding it. Don't keep feeding it. You're alert to it and you watch it. You can see what's the source of it, what are the causes, what's leading up to it. Be alert to them and maybe prevent it then. Prevent them from taking effect, as it were. When you understand what the causes are. And the more deeply we understand that, you know, the impermanence, the unchangeability, the impersonality of these things, the more we can let go of them. So less of our action becomes self-affirming. So they say that the fully enlightened person, the arahant, you know, all of their actions are totally non-self-affirming. They say they're their actions are, you know, imperturbable. Their actions have no effect anymore because they aren't acting out of self-interest anymore. They've seen that that self is really insubstantial. And that's, of course, when you begin to recognize and notice the depth of our self-interest, though, yeah, that's can be quite a big job. Usually they divide the levels of waking into four stages, you know, so, you know, okay. It takes us a while to peel back the various layers of self-interest. But the fully enlightened being, the arahant, they don't even fear death anymore. You know, there's nobody dying, they understand. All there is physical elements breaking up, mental processes coming to an end, that's all it is. Nobody dying. Can we do that yet? Got a few more stages to work on. But the first level is just knowing, just having that first insight into what really the sense of self is, just the process, impersonal process. And the more that we can apply that to our experiences, the less we build up more effects, self-preserving effects. Less self-inflating and self-preserving habits and ways of relating to body, speech, and mind. So on one hand, you know, the Buddha's teaching about the principle of kamma, ethical causality. I mean, it's important to recognize that our actions do have effects. It is perhaps a little bit harder to acknowledge them, especially when I mention it's based upon intention. But it, the more that we develop awareness with regard to our own actions, what we're saying and doing and thinking even, more we can begin to see these patterns, these habit patterns that we built up, and see how they lead to more effects, increased effects. Once we understand the processes involved, we can recognize, begin to see what, you know, what some of these effects are, some of our activities, see how they're causing us more disturbance, more suffering in our lives. Then we have a chance to change them. Yeah, certainly there's still some momentum to them, especially our habit tendencies, there's a lot of momentum to them, but there's a possibility to at least not keep feeding them again. Any more fuel to them, keep feeding them. And gradually they begin to fade out slowly. And of course, this is a matter of development. The whole Buddhist teachings, bhavana, the word actually means development, not just meditation, but spiritual development. And this requires, and I would say, the development of many different levels of our being. So some of the exercises and meditation practices, I mean, some of them have effects upon us, which maybe it's hard to recognize. You know, just the practice of something like metta bhavana, metta practice. It can be hard to recognize sometimes the effects that can have, just bringing up in your mind thoughts of well-being for yourself and other people. When some people hear about it, they think, oh, it's a little bit soppy because, you know, just well-wishing, yeah, but the well-wishes, they are a type of intention, good intention, you see. And the intention is kamma. Kamma has effect. Sometimes it's very hard to see directly the cause and effect relationships. It's more like being able to try and observe the patterns rather than the details. When the Buddha said that the results of kamma are some of the are part of the unthinkables, I think he was referring to the specifics. You know, it's very hard to say that, oh, you got this sore arm now because, you know, you hit an arahant in a past life or something. But if you keep observing your behavior, you can maybe notice certain patterns. Maybe you notice, you know, when you have a thought of aversion, your arm tenses up. You want to hit the person, you know. That's why you got a sore arm now, because you keep tensing your arm up to hit somebody. You say, maybe, I don't know, it's all hypothetical. But if you keep observing that pattern, you can see the cause and the effect processes there. Aha, yeah, that's why I got a sore shoulder, maybe. I get a bit of an intuition about it. And if you start, instead of feeding that aversion, that thought of aversion, you can maybe bring up some thoughts of friendliness, kindness, open-heartedness. And maybe you notice, hey, when I do that, my arm doesn't tense up. Aha, right. A different effect now. Change the action had a different effect. Then maybe after, you know, some time you notice, you just forgot about your sore arm now because it doesn't happen anymore. It might be important to be able to see these cause and effects directly. I mean, the Buddha mentions certain principles, but it's important for us to be able to see it in our own life, in our own actions. Action and result according to our own experiences then. And then when you learn that, you learn the principle and you learn the details too. How you can yourself change the effects of your actions. And your actions will change then too. So once we know about these certain principles, it's then the other part of it is to put it into practice. And still, it's the practice is still, there's the main principles of the practice. And I say, contemplate impermanence and unsatisfactoriness and not self, but there's still somebody there who's doing it, But being able to apply those particular, say, principles to our own experience, begin to notice. And they become clearer, those the way they're called the three characteristics of all existence. We begin to see them directly through our own actions, through our own personal story then. Then they become more, not only does our own story become less relevant, but those fundamental truths become more obvious to us. More present in our consciousness. We begin to see them. The Buddha says what they are. He gives us a little bit of a hint. But we begin to see them for ourselves. Then, yes, of course. Yep, now I know what he meant. And then the Buddha's teachings has had its effect, you could say. We put those teachings into practice. We see for ourselves. So. We're very fortunate to have this guidance, and then it's really up to us to put it into practice and see for ourselves. And you find out, if it really is working for you, if this really is the effective path of practice for us. We see that for ourselves with our own experience of well-being then. So I wish you all the best in your practice, and hopefully you'll be able to realize that peace of mind, the ultimate peace for yourselves then.
So. Satu
Bhagavata Namo Dhammang Namasami.
Supatipanno
Bhagavato Sāvaka Saṅgho.